Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to introduce my guest co-host, Dr. Kiona Gullett, one of our fabulous residents at UNC Family Medicine, who's filling in for Christy today. Welcome, Kiona.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good.
Good. Well, it's so nice that we're really moving towards spring, and we got some incredible conversations today with Dr. Anthony Vieira, who's back talking with us about updates on hypertension. Really excited about that. But first, we've got some important research that matters. We're going to be actually talking about blood pressure control and stroke, about cutting down sugary drink use by teens, about low back pain and disability, and about acetaminophen use in pregnancy. Things I think you may have some patients about as interested as well.
I do. I've had a few patients keep me up to date on these some of these articles.
Well, let's just talk about the very first article. Particularly, we're going to have Dr. Vieira on the show, but talking about blood pressure control and stroke. Why is that important?
Well, I think we, and we'll probably talk about this a little bit later, but unfortunately, we talk about blood pressure being this kind of silent killer. And a lot of times we, as patients, as family members, we don't realize how serious our high blood pressure is until we have a heart attack or until we have a stroke. And even then, not realizing or recognizing that there's still a lot of management that goes into controlling your blood pressure even after you have a serious event, regardless of how mild or severe it is. So it's a great topic, and I'm excited to dig into it.
Well, this particular research article that actually came out really helps us understand a little bit about once you've had a stroke, is it important to keep that blood pressure low and how low should you go? And this was research that was in the American Heart Association journal, appropriately called Stroke. And what tell us a little bit about the study.
So this study looked at roughly 4,000 patients who had just had an ischemic stroke.
Lack of oxygen
to their brain at anywhere between over the age of 35 and who were born between 1996 and who had the stroke between 1996 and 2003. These participants had a lot of risk factors, including blood pressure, high blood pressure over the goal baseline of 140 over 90, and they were kind of followed out from their stroke 6 months after their stroke and then up to a year or 2 years after their stroke.
And basically, they found that fewer than 30%, less than one out of three, maintained consistent blood pressure control three quarters of the time. And those who had an elevated blood pressure but that did get this good control reduced the risk of a second stroke by 54%, suggesting not only do you have to try to get your blood pressure down, you have to kind of keep it down. You have to be able to monitor your blood pressure. Two things that are important for doctors and patients.
Mm-hmm. And it's very true. I think you're right. It does take two to maintain this good controls as providers, doing the best we can for our patients to emphasize the importance of adequate blood pressure control, but also giving the patient's ownership of their medical conditions and implementing those lifestyle changes, compliance, or taking their medications regularly as prescribed.
We could say it takes two to tango.
Yeah.
Speaking of kind of tango, this next dance on this next research that matters is an interesting article in the Journal of School Health about those sugary drinks that a lot of people, not just teens, but a lot of adults use, and some interesting research about trying to change teens' habits.
Called sobriety challenge.
Sobriety. Yeah. Not an easy word to say three times fast. Sobriety. Well, what's the sobriety challenge, Kiana?
So the study, it actually is quite interesting, but they encouraged a group of teenagers to take a break from sugary drinks is how they worried it. So both sodas, sports drinks, flavored milk, flavored coffee for 30 days. And they followed them out, I think, up to a month after the study to see what habits were changed. And surprisingly enough, the youth our future. And they really stuck to this challenge. And they noted that the amount of soda consumption, which is the largest group of sugary drinks that teens take in, decreased over this 30-day period. And what they noticed is teens saw that, oh, I lost weight, I feel a little better, I've been drinking more water, which are all great things. And especially in our patient population, where we're seeing more and more rates of obesity in this age group, this is a great, great tool to empower our youth.
Right. I think there was nothing potentially bad in this whole effort here. It's not like
not
they drank
all.
More alcohol. They drank more water. I think we're going to promote this. It was just a pilot study. Who knows if it's maintained or not, but I think we both like this. We're going to put a link up there on our website, ask our health science research librarians, and promote this. Mm-hmm. So a good thing that we like. Speaking of things that I think we may not like, our next research that matters is about low back pain, Kiona. I don't know if you've ever had low back pain. I've had low back pain. It's no fun.
Mm-mm, not at all. And it's hard to convince yourself that more physical activity and movement makes it better.
Yeah, and it turns out in this particular research is really just looking at how much disability, how much days of work loss comes from low back pain, looking at studies from around the world and finding out that across gender, male and female, across different ages, across different countries, doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, you have a college education or high school education, or really even what work you do, low back pain is a common thing.
Mm-hmm. Very common. And, you know, I think that the part that I like that they highlighted the most is that the basics, getting back to the basics for improving back pain are maintaining your physical activity, getting back into stretching and strengthening exercises, which, like I said, is hard to wrap your mind behind. I have back pain, but you want me to do more activity.
It is, and the right activity. I know that once I tweaked my back just by, I get out of the shower and I lean quickly down to pick up the towel, but I didn't bend my knees to pick up the towel. Mm-hmm. And you're taught that you should bend your knees when you lean over.
Mm-hmm.
And so these common sense things, this was research in the Annals of the Rheumatic Diseases, and I think we're gonna post it up there, and we're going to encourage people to maybe take that back pain challenge, like this sobriety challenge, which is to do exercises for 30 days and see if you improve your back.
Mm-hmm. Specifically core. Exercises.
The things for your
abs, your back, your waistline.
Great idea. Mm-hmm. Well, very last research that matters is about the use of acetaminophen or Tylenol in pregnancy and a potential link to ADHD or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder like behaviors in children.
I found this very interesting. And I think I told you off air, Adam, earlier is that I actually had a patient of mine who was showing up for a newborn visit. And she said, oh, I heard about this article. You know, my kid is now 4 days old. I use Tylenol throughout my pregnancy for various aches and pains. What is going to be the outcome for my kid? So I had to do research on my own. And I find this this article interesting because they weren't actually able to find a direct association between the two.
Not a cause and effect. Right.
Association.
Found an association that the more acetaminophen you take and the later in the pregnancy, the more likely in some of this work, you could have attention deficit hyperactivity among your children, but half of all women just about take some acetaminophen during pregnancy.
Yes.
And so for me, and this was published in the journal JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics, nice combination there. Take home message for you of this research, what do you think? I mean, it's not causal, but what does it cause you to give you cause for concern?
I think I had to do a little bit more research for myself to tease this one out. What I liked was at the, and this is coming from the head maternal fetal medicine doctor at the Cleveland Clinic. He comments that if anything, what we get from this article is that for most aches and pains of pregnancy, maybe not giving medication, but also thinking of alternative ways.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters, Kiona. We've had a good chance to talk about blood pressure control and reducing second strokes, about cutting sugary drinks with teens.
And about Tylenol in pregnancy and the link to ADHD-like behaviors. This is a really great group of research articles.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Anthony Vieira, Associate Professor of UNT's Family Medicine's Hypertension Research Program about hypertension, cure, and control. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Kiona Gullett. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Kiona Gallette. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Anthony Vieira, Associate Professor at UNC Family Medicine and Program Director of UNC Family Medicine's Hypertension Research Program, about hypertension cure and control.
Welcome, Dr. Vieira, back to Your Health.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You know, I think you are one of our few guests that has been here now more than once, and so we're very honored to have you back here. And I think we are, like, so excited about today's conversations because there's so many things that are happening in the field of high blood pressure. But just to remind our listeners, if they perhaps didn't hear you a couple years ago, let our listeners know how you got interested in high blood pressure, as especially within family medicine. It's not like you were born that way, were you?
No, not at all. As you know, Adam, with family medicine, we see everything. And one reason I became interested in hypertension or high blood pressure is that so many of our patients have high blood pressure. And it's such an important and controllable risk factor for cardiovascular disease. There's also a personal element in it, and that is when I was beginning to do research, my father suffered from congestive heart failure. He was hospitalized during my fellowship, and it became clear that it was his heart failure was due to years of uncontrolled high blood pressure.
Wow. Wow. How's he doing now?
He's doing much better now that he's on medications. He's one of those guys who went from 0 to 9 in overnight, and meaning he went from 0 medications to 9, not just because he needed medications for blood pressure control, but because of the consequences of uncontrolled blood pressure, now needed to be on more medications to protect his heart and prevent further complications.
Very nice. Well, it's kind of nice to have that tie in to kind of push you in your efforts with, you know, getting our population overall well controlled. Do you have similar, like, patient interactions that kind of feed into your research?
Well, certainly, I like hypertension partly because it feeds into my clinical care every day. Mm-hmm. There's not probably a day that goes by in clinic that we don't see a patient with high blood pressure. And there are struggles that are ongoing and continual, struggles like getting people to take their blood pressure medication, getting people to understand why you're taking blood pressure medication. That is, that it's not only to lower blood pressure, but to prevent an unwanted or preventable cardiovascular event, to reduce strokes, to reduce kidney disease, to reduce heart failure. Very important.
When I was thinking about what's changed over the last decade or two since I started practicing, I remember being taught very early that it was the silent killer. And we still use that terminology, I think, to describe it to people. Tell us why it's called that, and should we continue to use that terminology, those terms, in describing it to people, or is there a better way of describing it that can help people really come to grips with what it is they have?
Yeah, it's obviously it's been called the silent killer because, generally speaking, you don't feel symptoms from high blood pressure. Some people may, if it's really high, they may have a headache or something like that. But generally speaking, someone can walk around with a really high blood pressure and not know it. So therein lies the problem, and that's why we have called it the silent killer. Killer because it leads to such devastating consequences as strokes, heart attacks, congestive heart failure where your heart doesn't pump very well. So those – and cardiovascular disease is the number one killer in the country. Strokes, number 3. So it is indeed a silent killer. I think it's an appropriate term.
And I know in my clinic I oftentimes get patients that say, well – you know, my mom, my grandmother, my aunt had high blood pressure, so I'm going to get it anyway. Or what are some ways that you kind of encourage patients to, in a sense, either prevent it or get the best outcomes for their hypertension?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one thing to note is that if you live in the United States, you have a 90% chance of developing high blood pressure over your lifetime. And I think that's largely due to the way we live in the United States, environmental factors. Now, there certainly is a genetic component to high blood pressure, but there are things that people can do to delay it or even prevent it altogether, things such as maintaining a healthy body weight. If you're overweight, lose weight. That is a powerful way to reduce blood pressure. Many people are sodium sensitive and can lower their blood pressure by lowering their intake of sodium, salt, in their diet. The problem with sodium in the diet is that most of it does not, in fact, come from our salt shakers that we add at the table, but from the restaurant and food preparation industry. So we need to watch what we buy from the store and what we order from restaurants. People can be told and hopefully will follow our advice to exercise more. That helps lower blood pressure over the long term. And then finally, people can be told to drink only in moderation if they drink alcohol at all. So those are some lifestyle things that people can do to prevent or delay high blood pressure.
You know, it makes me think back. I don't think I've ever mentioned it on the show, but my father had high blood pressure and has many, and my mother has high blood pressure. And so I have strong, that 90% would go way up. On the other hand, I became a vegetarian at a very young age when I was 19 in college. And so I altered the biology in some part, and I exercise a lot and try to think about ways that I can maintain a good weight. And thus far, I've not, knock on wood, developed high blood pressure. So I guess one question I have is, how well can you really alter the genetics? Like in my case, it looks like thus far I've been able to, or at least delay it. Can that happen for most people, you think?
Yeah, that's a good question, Adam. I think that one thing I failed to mention earlier is the dietary things one can do. You alluded to it when you said that you eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. The DASH diet, dietary approaches to stop hypertension, has been shown to be as good as a single blood pressure medication in lowering one's blood pressure. And therefore, if one were to adopt healthy the DASH eating plan, which consists of a lot of fruits and vegetables, basically replacing a lot of the sodium with potassium, limiting saturated fats and red meats, I think one can go a long way in delaying or even preventing hypertension from developing, along with doing the other things you mentioned, that is exercising, maintaining a healthy body weight, et cetera.
So I'm taking vitamin DASH.
Well,
medication DASH.
Yeah.
And kind of along those lines, I know some people like to take a herbal approach or a vitamin approach to kind of maintain or manage their chronic medical conditions. Are you aware of anything that's on the market that's safe for patients to use to help in assisting their blood pressure management?
Yeah, Keona, that's a great question. So there are lots of things that have been tried, like for many medical conditions. And there are things that people will say have helped them. The evidence is rather weak, though, on any supplements or things like supplements or herbals or other products like that that actually reduce blood pressure. It turns out, though, and I'll put a – you can't see my face, but I'm smiling here – that a piece of dark chocolate every day might actually lower blood pressure. And so I don't mind telling you that I have my piece of dark chocolate every night.
I might have to stop by the grocery store on the way
home.
Well,
even if it doesn't lower my blood pressure, it certainly makes me feel happy.
I think I brought some chocolate chip cookies in today. Hopefully it can be combined with a few other things. Dr. Vera, I know after we take a break, we're going to come back and we're going to really talk about your research because it's really fascinating, interesting, and relevant to people. But one thing, since you were here 2 years ago, things have changed. We were using some different cutoffs for what was high blood pressure and what our goals were and different ages. And it seems to have changed again, which I think could be confusing. It's confusing for doctors such as Keona and I, but help us understand and listeners understand what's their target blood pressure, the numbers they should be shooting for, and when is it okay to be satisfied perhaps with something different or not?
So, Adam, this is actually a more complicated question than we might have time for before the break. But I will say that, as you allude to, the guidelines have changed. In total, they haven't changed as much as people might think, though. One thing that the guideline writers did was they took a more careful look at the evidence, and they were very cautious to only recommend that which the evidence said they can legitimately recommend. And that's where the new cutoff of 150 systolic, the top number of the blood pressure, comes in for patients older than 60. The idea being that, according to the evidence, that is the level at which blood pressure medication ought to be administered. But the clinical considerations are many. One important one is that if patients are already on blood pressure medication and they're controlled at 140 or 138 over 80 and they're doing fine with it, there's no reason to back off the medication and titrate them back up to a blood pressure of 150. We know, for example, that starting at a normal blood pressure, for every 20 millimeters over 10 that it rises, your cardiovascular risk doubles. And so, and by definition, older age patients have higher absolute cardiovascular risk.
Well, thank you, Dr. Vieira. We need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Anthony Vieira, Associate Professor at UNC Family Medicine and Program Director of UNC Family Medicine's Hypertension Research Program, about hypertension cure and control. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Kiona Gallet.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Kiona Gallet. We've been talking with Dr. Anthony Vieira, Associate Professor at UNC Family Medicine and Program Director of UNC Family Medicine's Hypertension Research Program, about hypertension cure and control. And Dr. Vieira, you really are leading, I would say, a fascinating a dual life, a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde sort of thing, where you are a primary care doctor by day, and I'm sure at all other times of the day and night, you're doing incredibly interesting research on the issues that are really important to people. Give us a sense, our listeners, a sense of the type of research you do that helps inform the clinical decisions we all have to make.
Yeah, so one of the most important issues about blood pressure is measuring it. It seems so simple that we've been measuring blood pressure for hundreds of years. We honestly haven't changed the technique all that much. I mean, we started out with mercury, and now we no longer use mercury in the clinic. We use automated machines for the most part. I became really interested in how well the machines measure blood pressure. And also, a related matter is, even if they measure it very well at one instance in a person's day, does that define someone's blood pressure over the course of the 24 hours or a week or whatever the case may be? Yet we make important, life-changing, potentially, decisions based on a measurement taken in the office. So you've heard of white coat hypertension.
Right. When I walk into that doctor and I'm running late and I'm stressed, I got 50 things in my mind, and going, oh, my goodness, my blood pressure is going to be elevated and I'm anxious.
And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's high in the doctor's office. And what do you say, Adam? My blood pressure is always normal at home, Anthony. So that's white coat hypertension. That is that blood pressure elevated only in certain instances, the doctor's office classically for white coat, and then normal throughout the rest of the day. Well, you can detect that with a 24-hour blood pressure monitor. So my research has participants come in and wear a 24-hour blood pressure monitor to better characterize their blood pressure. And while white coat hypertension happens, you might think the opposite happens as well. And that is a particular area that I'm interested in. That is it possible that someone's blood pressure is actually not elevated in the doctor's office, but when they go about their day-to-day business, it is elevated, and their blood pressure is therefore not being detected as high, and therefore they're not being counseled or offered lifestyle recommendation advice or potentially medications. And you get the picture, ongoing damage to their kidneys, their blood vessels, their heart is happening, yet they're not caught at all. This is so-called masked hypertension, masked because it's, the doctors do not see it, the clinic does not see it. And so we are actually finding that the prevalence or the amount of masked hypertension that's out there is quite high. And so we have some papers coming out that will look at this.
In one case, you could stop someone's medicine perhaps because they have white coat hypertension they didn't need to. And the masked hypertension, you may think they maybe don't need it, but they really do.
Absolutely. So it turns out that, just as you say, Adam, that there are studies that show that people with white coat hypertension, really their risk is about the same as people who have always normal blood pressure. And importantly, people who have masked hypertension, their risk is almost as high as people who have always high blood pressure. And so we really need to figure out how to identify people like that and get them on medication probably. There are no studies to date that have actually randomized patients with mast hypertension to treatment or not to no treatment. It is an area that we're actively pursuing. So I think that in the future, we will see more use of ambulatory blood pressure monitoring supplemented by home blood pressure monitoring. But the point is that the clinic measure by itself is potentially limited in what we can do with it. We basically need to think about when we need more data, that is more blood pressure measurements.
So you're saying, Dr. Vieira, that the important thing is overall in a 24-hour period, what is your blood pressure at for majority of the day? So right. Not even just at one point throughout your day or at your clinic visit. We want to make sure that we're getting adequate control throughout majority of your day.
Right. So mm-hmm. The idea is it's not only what is my blood pressure right now, but what is my overall or usual blood pressure? What is it my blood pressure do during the course of the day? Is it always high? Does it only rise once in a while? Or is it always normal? Obviously, the latter being the best.
And what about those patients that can't afford the 24-hour blood pressure monitoring or their insurance doesn't pay for it? Are there alternatives to getting that data? For instance, CVS, Walmart, Walgreens, they all have the blood pressure monitor there. You can get them over the counter. How would you advise someone to get that information?
Yeah, Keone, that's a great question. So one thing to mention right away is that right now, we do not have the resources to do ambulatory blood pressure monitoring on every patient in the country. We don't even have the resources necessarily to do it on the people we suspect have white coat hypertension. So there's this one strategy would be to think about how we would identify patients who are more likely to benefit from having the ABPM and then using it on those patients.
That's the ambulatory blood pressure monitor.
Right. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. ABPM, ambulatory blood pressure monitor. Another strategy would be to supplement, as you sort of are hinting to, with some sort of other method of out-of-office blood pressure measurements. Now, you can do that with home blood pressure monitoring, buying a machine, for example, at the drugstore and taking it home and using it and recording the readings. That obviously is limited in that it's also only going to catch the readings during which time you sit down with the monitor, hopefully performing it correctly, and write them down. It's not going to catch the readings all 24 hours, which is particularly relevant to probably the workday. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if you're going to a pharmacy, you're only going to get the reading when you're there at the pharmacy, and the validity or the accuracy of those machines has been called into question. And even if accurate, you still can't be in the machine for 24 hours.
Yeah. So do you advise patients to do self-monitoring of their blood pressure? And which monitor do you recommend? I get this question a lot, and I always say, let me ask Dr. Vieira.
Right. So I do actually advise people to use home blood pressure monitoring. We did a study a number of years ago, I think it was 2008, where we surveyed patients across North Carolina about whether they use a home blood pressure monitor. These were patients identified as having hypertension or high blood pressure. It turns out that 41% of patients with high blood pressure in this sample reported using a home blood pressure monitor, but very few were doing so under the guidance of a clinician. And so I'm careful to tell patients that I want to make sure they're doing it properly, not doing it only when they have a headache or don't feel well or just got out of an argument, because that's not the best time to check your blood pressure. So I really go through with patients about how to systematically collect the readings, how to perform it correctly, how to write them all down, not just the good ones, and to do it sort of in a fashion that is going to give me the best data possible. So I think that it is fine for patients to use the home blood pressure monitor, but I think they do need to do so with the guidance of a clinician and, bring those readings in, and then it sort of informs the decision-making.
And you hinted a few times at taking the blood pressure correctly. Are there a few steps that you can advise our listeners on how to get accurate blood pressure readings?
Yes, excellent. So there are a few basic steps. One is to make sure the person is sitting down and has rested 5 minutes is the usual kind of guideline. The feet should be on the floor, flat on the floor, not dangling, not legs crossed. The arm should be at heart level, on the table, resting. And then the monitor cuff needs to be the appropriate size. And so that's another issue that ought to be checked by the clinician or the doctor in the doctor's office. And then they should take three readings in a row, 1 minute apart, and write them all down. And that way you're getting sort of this, the idea is you're getting the best readings you possibly can from the home monitor. So those are the basic steps.
Well, we're going to put a picture of Dr. Vera demonstrating this perhaps on our website. And we really want to thank you, Dr. Anthony Vieira, Associate Professor. I think you've gotten promoted since the last time you were on the show, and we're looking forward to your next promotion to full professor, rising star at the UNC Department of Family Medicine and Director of our Hypertension Research Program. Thank you for being our guest today and bringing to us updates that are probably one of the, if not perhaps the most important problem facing patients across the United States and the world.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Kiona Golub. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segment of our show today, we will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first house call question today about concerns of Alzheimer's disease.
My mother is 95 years old and currently suffering from Alzheimer's disease and is in hospice care. Although I believe in the power of medicine, I also believe that we should let God be God. She has suffered throughout bouts of pneumonia, UTIs, and multiple falls while wasting away before my very eyes. I love my mother, and I know that she would not want to live this way. How do I tell her healthcare providers that I do not want medication given to her to prolong her suffering?
Wow. That's a really powerful family story that you shared. Thank you so much for sharing that. What do you think, Kiona?
Yeah, and I think the fact that she is plugged into hospice illustrates that you guys have had conversations like this in the past, conversations about goals of care. And it sounds as if you are coming from a place of love and understanding of what your mother's wishes are. The goals of hospice are to make sure that people maintain their comfort at the later stages of their illness. In all the things that you're doing so far, you're doing a great job of kind of outlining those things that she wants.
You know, and I think you're asking, how do you let the healthcare providers? I think you just let all the healthcare providers know quite clearly with what you just told us. And I think that, just like Kiona mentioned, you really have indicated these are her wishes. Hopefully she has a healthcare power of attorney document that lets you be the full decision maker. And she's has advanced directives and a living will, which we encourage both and all of our patients to have these types of documents, because then your wishes and her wishes are completely aligned and there's absolutely no questions about it. And it sounds like that she is in the dying process and you're supporting her in that. So we applaud you for the care you are giving. Mm-hmm. Erica, what's our very next house call?
My stress levels have been higher than usual. I work in a highly stressful company that has no belief in a work-life balance. Both my parents and in-laws are in declining health, and my husband and I are raising three children in their teens. I've been feeling sick recently and think my stress may be a factor of this. Can stress make you sick with something more than a cold?
I think stress certainly can manifest in many different ways. Some people harbor their stress kind of in their stomachs and have diarrhea, have abdominal pain or belly pain. Some people can have stress-induced heart problems, skin disorders, effects on their overall mood. So we certainly can see that tie. I think it's important that you're recognizing that you don't have as much work-life balance, and it'd be important to kind of figure out ways to create that for yourself.
We know those extremes of stress, Kiona, that you mentioned, like acute stress disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder. Generalized anxiety just follows a continuum, and stress kind of contributes to all of these things. We all have stress in our lives. But when you start describing things that are kind of beyond which are comfortable, that's when you really need to get help. And your question is a good kind of opens the door to having a conversation. We encourage you to have a conversation with your family doctor, your primary care doctor, about this. Maybe you want to talk with the mental health specialist and work on some behavioral strategies.
Very true.
Yeah.
The best of us could use a little additional help from a mental health specialist. We deal with a lot on a day-to-day basis, and it certainly seems like you have a lot on your plate for anyone.
As a resident, you don't know anything about this work-life balance, do you? You don't have any life. It's just all work, but only 80 hours a week.
Only 80 hours a week.
You can certainly understand that. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I've been experiencing severe discomfort in my abdominal area for about a week. I have an ultrasound which found absolutely nothing abnormal, and I'm scheduled to undergo a colonoscopy and an endoscopy next week. I would appreciate your thoughts.
Well, this is a kind of a more detailed question. We probably have time to go into real in-depth, Keona, but I'd be curious what you think here. A lot of times we rush to test. And we just had a question from a previous listener about stress. And while we don't want to assume that stress is causing it, we know for a lot of people they can have stress-induced stomach problems, but they can have so many other problems too. So the testing sometimes is necessary, but when it's negative, it leaves us with a lot of times questions,
not necessarily
answers.
Yeah, it's not really reassuring because we like to have answers. We're in a society where we ask a question and we get our answers. And I would encourage you to talk to your primary care doctor and be open about your symptoms. Keep a diary of your symptoms, because you might find that even if these tests are negative, it might be something that you're eating or drinking or not eating or drinking that can be tied to it, or could be tied to your stress or your day-to-day activity.
Great suggestion. We always say, when in doubt, take a history. If you're still in doubt, take another history. Mm-hmm. And in doubt, perform a physical exam. So go back to your basics. Thanks for your question. Erica, what's our very last house call?
A family friend's mother has recently been admitted to the hospital and was diagnosed as being septic. She is doing better, and although she remains in the hospital under observation, when I heard this, I was shocked. My grandmother passed away from sepsis 8 years ago. I thought that if you were septic, you were a goner. Is there a medication now available that was not available in the past?
That's a great question. Septic, or being having sepsis, is a disorder where you have a diffuse or pretty much everywhere in your body infection, and your system is kind of crazy. And the best way to kind of treat it are getting antibiotics and fluids and supportive therapy on board. There's a big spectrum of that. You can have sepsis and appear very well, and you can be septic and need higher level care, like in an intensive care unit. It's difficult to say, what was the case with your mother. But I think in any rate, even back then, the best thing is early diagnosis and management.
And I think that what's made a real difference is people get antibiotics into people within an hour.
Mm-hmm.
That's the gold standard. Within an hour of getting to the emergency room, antibiotics should be started. If that blood pressure is low, you've got a high fever, don't wait to figure out 24 hours later.
Mm-hmm.
You would be a goner.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that question and really all of our questions today. We've had a good chance to answer some really important questions to your health. And if you have anything you'd like to have us talk about in an upcoming show, send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. Well, that'll conclude the House Call segment of our show today. And we want to really thank all of our listeners for listening today. And we hope that we've addressed issues that are important to you. And again, you can send us your own questions and stories at yourhealth@unc.edu.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guest today, Dr. Anthony Vieira, and my guest co-host today, Dr. Adam Goldstein. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We look forward to talking with you again next week.
Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.